Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The ERP has really changed the game on this thing because there are certain commodities, because their prices have increased, that they're going to get big increases in the reference prices with Congress doing nothing because that's current law.
Dr. Joe Outlaw, participating in a recent Farm Foundation forum, he's the co-director of the Agriculture Food Policy Center.
And specifically, you look at corn and beans and even wheat's going to get an increase, sorghum. But it's not across the board. So that's where you get to where people looking at things differently, because some are already going to get an increase. Some are got nothing and they don't have any prospects for help, like rice, for example.
This is Agriculture Today.
Talking about those farms, some of those beginning and small family farms.
Dr. Stephen Wallander is senior economist for the Democrats on the Senate Ag Committee.
We want to make sure that the programs are targeted appropriately to helping these farms succeed, helping them grow, helping them become the farms of the future. In the farm safety net side, this means looking closely at who faces this risk of those. We saw looking at kind of average, what are the chances of negative net returns for farms going into the future? That varies a lot with farm size. This chart here is adapted from some statistics in the 2022 America's Family Farm and Ranches report, pulling out the percentage of farms, those family farms by size class, where farming is a primary occupation. What percent of them are facing low or negative net income in that year? And we see all farms of all sizes face this risk, right? About 20% of the large farms face this risk. Twice that percentage of the small moderate sales farms face that risk, and 81% of the small low sales farms face that risk. And yet these small farms are oftentimes less likely to be getting government payments. And so trying to figure out where there might be a gap in targeting, where there might be a gap in eligibility, is an important piece for improving those programs going into the future. And these differences across farm size come up in other spaces too. They come up in conservation programs where we look at transaction costs and application barriers. And they come up as we're thinking about program streamlining, and trying to build on, recent changes within existing programs that are working to reduce the amount of paperwork that it takes to interact with USDA and to get into these programs. So just to close, when we're talking about farm risk and we're talking about being forward looking, climate change is a key issue. Right. It is a major risk impacting farms today. Syngenta had a recent survey that looked and showed that 70% of farms are concerned about the effect of climate change in the future, and 87% feel that they're experiencing at least some climate impacts today. But climate change is a bit of a glass half full, glass half empty kind of situations for farms and ranches, dairies, working forests. On the glass half empty side, they are facing greater risk. Weather shocks are becoming more frequent and more extreme. The chart we have here is from the National Climate Assessment. It's showing the expected percent change in extreme precipitation. And everywhere in the country is seeing some increase in extreme precipitation. If we look at the change in drought map, it's going to look similar, right? And so those are the sort of local impacts from climate change. Those changes are happening around the globe as well. And so even when you don't get those shocks locally, you often end up with increased price risk because of that volatility around the world. On the glass half full side, though, the good news is that farmers are in a well positioned to be part of the solution. There are a lot of things they can do to sequester more carbon in the soil and in the trees, a lot of things they can do to reduce their own greenhouse gas emissions. They're often working very closely with their commodity organizations and with their suppliers to look at the emissions along the entire supply chain. And importantly, we're still using the voluntary incentivized programs that are the foundation of our working lands conservation policy. And we've seen big investments in this space through the Inflation Reduction Act and the Climate Smart Commodities programs. We just got, within the last week or two, information from USDA on what that first tranche of funding looked like in terms of the sign-up, and we saw overwhelming interest from farmers. Many of the programs were 75 or 80% oversubscribed, meaning that you've got a bunch of farms and ranches and forests lined up for next year's tranche of funding.
Speaking at a Farm Foundation forum on what to expect from the 23 Farm Bill, it's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Dr. Harris, I understand you've pursued answers from the administration on this matter. Can you expand on what appears to be the intent of the Climate Smart Commodities Pilot Program and why it was awarded $3.5 billion out of the CCC in 2022?
Earlier in the week, in the Rules Committee, an amendment from Representative Andy Harris from Maryland being questioned by Nick Langworthy of New York.
The Commodity Credit Corporation exists for the ability to do the things that we outline. It's a it helps with crop loss. It helps with farmers. It helps with farmer-related issues. These are the things that it's supposed to help with. And it's, of course, as you know, it can be, the limit is $30 billion in the corporation. Usual expenditures 10 to 15, creating about a $15 billion cushion where the secretary, the current secretary, abused the discretion given for COVID in it to create, to fund programs like the one you mentioned. Now, I believe that we should return the Commodity Credit Corporation to what it was created to do, not as a slush fund. And I don't care which secretary uses it as a slush fund. It's not a slush fund. It's there for the farmers. And to put it in perspective, and we're talking about, you know, we're talking about, you know, 100 million here and 100 million there, and look, in Washington, that's not a lot of money. But $3.5 billion for that program is a lot of money. That's actually a significant chunk out of what our discretionary expenditure level is for this program. So what we do is we merely return the rules on secretary discretion to the pre-COVID rules, restricting the discretion, which I think was abused. And the score we got back was only $1 billion in savings. I think we're actually going to save multiple billions of dollars based on what the experience has been in this program over the past few years. But it's a very worthwhile question. This is a perfect example of end runs by this administration around congressional intent.
Can you reiterate for us what the bill does to make changes to discretionary spending authority to prevent this sort of manipulation of the Commodity Credit Corporation moving forward?
As I said, what the bill does is it restores the pre-COVID guardrails put on the secretary as to what they can use the monies in this fund to do. You know, there are other examples over the past 2 years of where congressional intent was clearly bypassed by the secretary. And again, we're not talking about $10 million. We're not talking about $100 million. We're talking about $1 billion or $3.5 billion in that case.
It's a ton of money.
An amendment again to the Ag Appropriations Bill being considered by the House.
Thank you. I know producers in my district, they agree with me when I say that I appreciate the work that's been done on this bill to bring more accountability on how these tax dollars intended to support our farmers are actually being spent. As we know, the Commodity Credit Corporation since 1933 has provided farmers with stability, you know, amid global volatilities, including commodity and income support, export promotion, and other important tools. Now, unfortunately, as you point out, Mr. Chairman, we have seen the Biden administration ignore this program's intended function, instead treat this as just another slush fund for the Green New Deal priorities. This legislation is an important step to prevent the administration from further abusing programs that were intended to support our farmers and protect America's long-term food security.
And this is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
For our larger net worth farm families, if today you can pass $26 million down to the next generation, either during your lifetime or in death, but after January 1st, 2026, you only can pass $14 million.
Brendan Dirkschneider is president of Insurance Design Management in Omaha.
You just gave an opportunity to pass an additional $12 million of assets down to the next generation without paying tax. So if you do no planning, you just voluntarily paid 40% on $12 million or a $4.8 million tax because you didn't want to do any planning. So that is very, very important when we talk about succession planning, because with real estate prices the way they are, it doesn't take too many acres and other assets to get over that dollar amount after January 1st, 2026.
He also outlines that part of the planning process in a succession plan is understanding basis.
So when we talk about basis, if you give an asset away, the donee retains the donor's basis. So if I want to give 80 acres to my girls and I paid $1,000 an acre and today it's worth $10,000 an acre, if I give it to them, they have my same basis, that $1,000 basis. But if I hold on to that 80 acres until I pass away, they get a step up in basis, and they get a step up in basis of that $10,000. Well, why is that step up in basis important? Well, the step up in basis is important only in the event if my daughters would want to sell or were able to sell that farm ground. Then that base step up in basis becomes important, because if they turn around, they sell it for $10,000 an acre and they got a step up in basis of $10,000 an acre, we just eliminated the capital gain tax that would have been due on that asset. Again, voluntary tax in nature on that situation. Why would we wait until we pass away to give certain assets away? And this is where it really gets important on the communication side, because you may say, okay, if I have little Susie who's back in the operation and she's contributing her sweat equity to the operation, and I want to start helping her build her balance sheet or her net worth so she can continue to grow the operation earlier on in her career, maybe I'm going to give her a certain number of acres. If I give her acres, she retains my basis. She doesn't get the step up in basis. But if she's the active farm child, is she going to sell that asset? Does it really matter what her basis is if she's the active farm child and she's going to farm those acres? Well, maybe not. Maybe the step up in basis is not important. But that inactive child that we believe is going to inherit some farm ground, well, maybe mom and dad need that farm ground to maintain their financial independence. Maybe they need the cash rental income off those acres so they're financially independent away from the family farm operation. Well, if you're giving something to Susie and you're not giving something to her brother, little Johnny, do they think it's fair? Well, they may be disappointed. But if we explain to them and help them understand the why, and we say, okay, Johnny, if we give this to you today and you turn around and sell it, you're going to go capital gain tax on the gain at $9,000 an acre. But if mom and dad retain it for the next 10 to 15 years and we get to keep the income stream off of it, and then you inherit it and you get a step up in basis, we just eliminated your capital gain tax and now you get 100% dollar on dollar for what you were potentially going to sell that asset for. Now, all of a sudden, the inactive child is like, okay, hey, I understand why my sister or brother got something today, and I'm going to have to wait a number of years before I inherit my share. So those are the conversations when succession planning becomes very important regarding basis.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, obviously, the database of farms that we have represents 775 different producers across this country in 22 different states.
Dr. Joe Outlaw is co-director of Texas A&M's Agriculture Food Policy Center.
So we have a lot of perspective. I get a lot of perspective on a daily basis. They'll call and email me and tell me when they see something I've said in the press they don't agree with. I get a lot of feedback. So, one of the things that you need to understand, and I think as Stephen mentioned it earlier and the economist spoke, our safety net programs have nothing to do with the cost of production currently. And that's one of the biggest thing that I get asked about. And the thing that you have to really consider right now is because they don't have any tie to the cost of production, that's why people are saying that the reference price increase needs to be taken into consideration. But in terms of adjustments, and one of the chat questions I saw said, why don't producers just grow something else? And the answer is pretty simple. They will within a certain complex. If you look at the Midwest where you're from, it's corn and soybeans and some other stuff occasionally, but it's really corn and beans, right? And that's for many, many years, that's been the bread and butter. And it should be doing that. Well, I'll just take another example of down in Texas. We have a lot of cotton, obviously, and that is very, very specific equipment. So if you buy a cotton stripper for $1 million, something that helps you harvest your cotton, you cannot use it for anything else other than a paperweight because it doesn't transfer. And so, just understand that in big time production agriculture, there are some minor shifts that producers can do to manage, hey, this crop isn't quite very profitable, I'm going to go with this one. We see it all the time. The Midwest can do corn and beans, and their producers are constantly guessing at which one is everybody going to produce this year so I can produce the other one and get a little bit higher price. There's all those gives and takes going across. But in terms of farm management, what you would do, I think that we are as lean and mean in this country's agriculture as you could possibly get. What does that mean? That means that because we have this database of costs, these people are pushing on the very edge of low-cost production. They adopt technology. They're very much early adopters of technology so that they can be low-cost. And to be low-cost, I mean, so we're constantly moving. And when you do that, you tend to move towards larger sizes. And, you know, that's a whole nother debate in this country of large farms versus small farms. But the main thing is, I think that producers try to be as efficient as they possibly can. They would rather, and you know this as well as I do, most of the producers would say, I'd rather not have the government involved at all. They would. And my answer to that is, you're right, but the fact of the matter is that most of the other countries around the world have some sort of protections, and why wouldn't we have some sort of safety net? Most people hear the word safety net, and they think it's called a guarantee of profit. That is not what we're talking about here. When I say they're getting safety net payments, that means they're making up a portion of the loss that they would have incurred.
And then there's ERP.
There's ERP, the effective reference price, which is what I was referring to. And with some commodities prices having moved up, and it's by formula, the previous 5 years, Olympic average, you can get an effective reference price. And some of them this year are going to have really nice increases. And that's one of the things, you got the haves and the have-nots based on what's going on with markets. And so there's probably different commodities would have different pressure for a reference price increase because of that.
Outlaw, part of the recent Farm Foundation Forum. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I need to figure out how I can get myself some board and pay mandatory salary, and I'll be coming here and lobbying you very hard that I get my $1 million and tell how awful will farmers are not going to survive if you not pay me $1 million a year. So I think this is very clever, but I think Congress needs to look at some of this stuff and really need to do.
Representative Victoria Spartz from the 5th District of Indiana on an amendment that would prohibit federal funds from being used by commodity checkoff programs.
I think this amendment, you know, addresses just one part. Make sure we also don't use taxpayer dollars too, you know, make sure, because we don't even know what they're doing. And I think in the farm bill, you know, we need to really look how we can bring transparency, because I truly believe, you know, this is becoming to the point like we actually legislate and help some of this. It's not even special interest group. It's some people and boards that sit and make very hefty salary, probably spend most of this money and then probably even to their friends to promote it. Who does know? Because the interesting thing about the dairy, you know, the dairy farmers were struggling. A lot of them were merging and bankrupt. So actually the industry was going, you know, downhill, and they were keep getting more and more salaries. And it's very convenient when you go there, you make $200,000, and then you go suddenly, you leave administration, make almost $1 million, almost five times more, than go back and forth. And it seems to me that's becoming where this board just go between different bureaucrats, between agencies, and they don't actually, a lot of times, and I had experience where they were not promoting and supporting in some pro-farm bills when I was state senator. I was surprised why these boards would not want to support things that are good for farmers, because farmers from my district were actually asking me with some legislation, and this group first were going to oppose, including Farm Bureau. I was like, which board authorized you to do that? I'm like, I know a lot of farmers. They were going, and then some of them stay neutral. And I'm like, what do you mean stay neutral? This is something I try to help you farmers on the ground. So this is a big problem we have, and I think Congress should not even have mandatory fees like that. But the least we can do, you know, we can bring transparency and preclude that more money going, because unfortunately, you know, we are not, you know, doing as good of a job authorizing a lot of stuff. And it seems like, again, we'll have more unauthorized spending. It's increasing, not decreasing, this Congress. And it's sad for me to see that.
Representative Thomas Massey is from the 4th District of Kentucky.
So the irony of the situation we have now is who's responsible for oversight of these checkoff programs right now? Which department of the government?
Well, supposedly, like, USDA is doing it, but when right. You talk to them, they're claiming, you know, they're not. And actually, Government Accountability Office raised these issues. you know, that we need to have more accountability because USDA is actually not an auditor itself. So we really need to make sure that there is more accountability and auditing of these programs, because ultimately we're forcing taxpayers, and this is just a limited group of taxpayers, but farmers, to pay a tax.
Well,
you know,
the danger of it is if the USDA is entrusted with any form of oversight over these checkoff programs, the person running the USDA right now drew almost $1 million a year for the 4 years before he became in charge of the organization. That seems problematic to me. Just one other thing I want to comment on your amendment. $1 seems like such a small amount. Like if you sell a calf at an auction, you may get $500 for it. And so people say, well, $1 is not much, but it would, a farmer would be lucky to make $100 of profit on that calf. So $1 is 1%, a 1% tax that goes to an organization that doesn't have transparency. And if there's a drought or something, the farmer may be lucky to make $10 on that calf, in which case it's a 10% tax.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So at minimum, every one of you should consider putting a will in place.
Recent webinar on succession planning, Brendan Dirkschneider, president of Insurance Design Management in Omaha.
A will is that legal document that does not take effect until you pass away. It takes effect at your death. So as long as you're alive, you can make changes and adjustments or amend or start all completely over with a new will, as long as you're alive and are mentally competent. Okay. Once you pass away, that will takes effect. That is in a legal document. It will name an executor of your estate, and that executor will take that will and go to the county courthouse and say, Mr. or Mrs. Smith has passed away. I need to begin to distribute assets according to their will. That process is called probate, and we'll talk about probate here in a little bit. The other aspect a will does, especially for those of you that are the younger generation, maybe have minor children at home, is it would also name a guardian who should take care of my minor children in the event that me or my spouse cannot. Those guardians here in the state of Nebraska, the legal age of majority is 19. So if you have children that are younger, it would name a guardian to watch over those children. Your will could also establish what's called a testamentary trust, which if you leave minor children, all your assets can be dumped into this testamentary trust, and you would name a trustee to manage those assets for the benefit of your children. So a will, at minimum, is a document that everyone should consider as a part of their estate planning process. We talked about probate. Probate is a very important aspect with the aspect of the will, because it is a court supervised distribution of assets, and it does have its advantages. It ensures that your assets are distributed according to your will. It limits the time you can challenge a will, but it also limits the time creditors can make claims against your estate. But unfortunately, there's also some disadvantages with probate. Probate can be a lengthy process. It can be a very costly process. And it's also a public process. So people are going to know what you own and who it went to. And unfortunately, most of us like to keep our assets private. So if you have a will and you want to avoid probate, you need to do some additional planning. Because can you avoid probate? Yes.
And on revocable trust?
So a revocable trust, are there advantages? Yes, because it absolutely avoids probate. Nobody's going to know what assets you have. Nobody's going to know who's going to receive your assets. You don't have to go through that probate process. It does provide incapacity planning and asset management. It protects the privacy of your loved ones, and it does reduce administrative burden on your loved ones, because the trustee has to do exactly what the patriarch and matriarch stated in the trust document, and they don't have to make decisions on who gets what or how things are going to be operated, because the trust document will usually have that all laid out. Now, the disadvantages of a revocable trust, yeah, it is more complex, it's more work up front, and it's usually a higher initial cost too than maybe just writing up a will. But you're going to save a tremendous amount of money, because if you don't have to go through probate, you don't experience that probate cost. And unfortunately, we're still seeing a lot of attorneys charge a percentage of an estate when it comes to probate. And unfortunately, that's just an antiquated, outdated pricing model. Most of the law firms that we work with will charge you a fee, and you'll know exactly what it costs. to settle an estate rather than paying maybe 2% to settle an estate. So it may cost you a little bit more upfront, but there's significant savings on the backside when you're trying to settle an estate with a trust versus just having a will.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
If you do the grocery shopping at your house, you know firsthand that food prices have gone up a lot in the last 3 years, especially in 2022. But there is some good news on the food price front. The latest forecast for food price inflation at the grocery store this year is for prices to end up 5% higher this year than last. And that
is well below the 11.4% increase we saw in 2022.
USDA economist Matt McLaughlin told us, no, we have not seen overall grocery price inflation disappear this year, but
what we have seen this whole year is very gradual disinflation, or not price decreases, but a slowing of price increases. And we expect them also to continue into the future as well.
Yes, in fact, Matt's early forecast for 2024 is for grocery store food prices to rise, but only by 1.6%. The average yearly food inflation rate over the last 20 years has just been 2%. So we may finally see
prices returning to normalcy.
Gary Crawford, Washington.